session number 10413, reel 14.
Mr. George South, reel 14. You were telling me that Montgomery, when he visited you at Haverhill, had told you...
Well, he told us that 50 Div would be one of the leading divisions in the invasion, and the morale just went down, and there was quite a lot of discussion about it after he'd gone, mate, that there was a lot of divisions lying about in the country that had never been on active service or hadn't seen as much active service as us, and that they didn't think it was right that we should do the invasion.
Was Montgomery actually, I mean, you knew him from when you worked at the VIP officers' mess, but was he actually popular with the men of the 8th Battalion when you were with them? Would it be fair to say he was popular? Or was he?
I wouldn't say he was popular.
What was their attitude to him?
I would think it would be about 50-50. About 50% liked Montgomery. Thought there was nobody like Montgomery. And 50% didn't like him, although they accepted him as a leader. And anyhow, after he'd gone, as I say, there was this argy-bargy about why the hell should we do this?
Did it show itself in any way, this discussion?
At first it did. A lot of people were bitter and felt, well, you know, we've done all the fighting out of the war. Let somebody else have a go.
Was there any actual problems with discipline?
Oh no, there was no problems with discipline. There were more of the soldiers. What can I say now? The one thing you can do without being disciplined is moan, and there was a lot of moaning about it. Eventually, we went to Southwold.
That'd be March 12th, I think.
Mm, somewhere around about there. Where training stepped up. And my company commander had a soft word in my ear that now was the time to forget all my illnesses and become a soldier, which I accepted. And then...
Who was your company commander, by the way?
Chris Beattie, Major Beattie. We stepped it up.
Were you doing any of the new methods of training that had been introduced in England while you were away?
Not at that particular time. We came into them from Southwold. First of all, we were introduced to these new weapons they had.
What were they?
They'd improved the Scorpion, you know, what we used to call the flail. You used to go through a minefield with a roller on the front with long chains on, beating the, we used to call them a flame, tank. They became the Scorpion, wasn't it? The Scorpion? I think it was the Scorpion. And they showed us the new weapons, the Sten.
What did you think of the Sten? That was
not very much. Because it would fire when it shouldn't and wouldn't fire when it should.
Can you just explain that a bit more?
Well, if you bounced it on the bottom, it would fire, even although it was on safety. You know, if you're doing drill, or you're anywhere, and you had rounds in, and you tap the heel of the butt, it would fire, even if it was on safety. And many times, it's jammed. You know, you press the trigger and nothing happened. And it took a long time before people would trust it.
Did they get better?
They got better at the end, yes. But the first ones out were very femme. They used to say it cost half a crown to make one out of a bit of hard drain pipe, because that's all it looked like, with a barrel and a bit of pipe around it. And we went into extensive training then.
Did you like the idea of the Sten, of the automatic, you know, that you could carry about?
I remember once at Honiton, we were issued with Thompson submachine guns just after Dunkirk, you know, when there was very few weapons knocking about. And they were great. The only thing was they fired dum-dums, and so they were taken away from us because the ammunition was dum-dum, which, according to the Geneva Convention, you weren't allowed to use. And of course, when we got the Standard O champion, but as I say, there was that many faults with them that people couldn't rely on them.
Was there anything else new that you got?
The Piat gun. And that was the only weapon we got.
What did you think of the Piat?
Providing you fired it correctly was a good gun. If you didn't fire it correctly, you either had a broken shoulder or you missed the target. And being used to people, you know, going from the Bren gun to a Piat, a Bren gun, the shock of recoil is instantaneous, where a Piat gun, you press the trigger and there's a terrible gap before you get the shock of recoil. And people were pressing the trigger at first and then relaxing, and then the shock of recoil would come, and oh boy, no end of people had bruised shoulders and that. And so you had to get a man that was adapted himself to it, knew how to fire it, and you made him the Piat gunner, because he only had one per platoon.
Did you get any bikes while you were there? Were you one of the companies who got bikes?
We didn't get any bikes till later on. You always had the old company bike with a back pedal brake that the runner used. You always had them. And we got a mule at one time. Oh, that was in Sicily, we had a mule, that's right, when we were doing mountain fighting. And we did invasion training.
What was invasion training? What did it actually consist of?
Well, we used to go on board LCTs. They didn't go out to sea or anything, they were there. And drop the ramp and charge up the beach.
Do you mean LCIs?
LCIs. But you had LCT there with the lorries and that, I guess, and that. And you used to charge up the beach. And it was just to get you fit again. And by then, we'd accepted, I think. I think the thing that did it was the power of the new, you know, the 25 pounders and these long range guns, and the Sherman tanks with these long barrels instead of the short barrels. The morale built up again, and
so the actual material that was behind the invasion actually Okay, made you feel confident.
It built your morale up. And as I say, we were going along, you know, different places, doing attacks and running up beaches and one thing or another. And you got into the way of it. And then we'd been there, what, maybe it was a month or 5 weeks, I would think. And then we went down to Southampton. To, what did you call that place now? We moved down to Tootild Camp at Romsey. Now, I also remember when we got settled in, the first thing I always do is I was scrounging around see what's going on. And I walked into this, up to this field, and it had rocket guns. A field full of them. When I got a good look at them, the wooden ones. Yeah. And we were there a few days, and then we went on invasion training again. And we went onto LCIs, down to Southampton, got on the LCIs and the carriers on the LCTs and that. And we did go out to sea. And did a dawn attack on the beaches.
How did it go? What did you learn from it?
Well, we didn't learn a lot because it was a straightforward, you know, up the beach and into the woods. There was nobody, at that particular time, there was nobody firing live ammunition at us, you know. But further in, we were fired upon. And it was more like it then. And then we came back to, I think we were away 3 days. Came back to Tootild. And by then, a lot of the lads had their the girlfriends and the wives down in Southampton. And we were back to the family again. And we used to go into Southampton on a night time. And unfortunately, there was a battle every night with the Yanks.
Why was that?
Well,
why didn't you like them? What was the cause of the friction?
The cause of the friction was money. They were oversexed, overpaid. And we used to chase them out the bowsers, because they could get bows when we couldn't, because they could afford to, you know, give a fistful of dollars where we couldn't. We didn't get a fistful of dollars a week, never mind for a pint of beer. And Eisenhower came to see us and gave us a lecture about the American soldier, why we were always bickering at one another, and he said exactly the same as what I said, overpaid, oversexed, and said, but when we get to the other side, they will show you the road home. They will show you how to fight. And that was the worst thing he could have said. Because that night in Southampton, there was blood flowing down the rivers. And not long after that, we were...
Would you be involved in that sort of friction? Can you remember any sort of incident from it? Or would it...
I was never involved in it until it came where I was at. And then I was like the rest of the lads. I piled in.
What sort of incident would set it up? Can you remember?
Yes, you would get a, you would get, you'd be in a bar, maybe with friends, civilian friends, and the Yanks would come in, shove through, you know, shove you aside like, you know, you think they're still in Chicago or somewhere, and start making the mouth calls. And I mean, I used to sit with a man and woman, and they had twin daughters. And me and my mate, we used to go and have our supper with these people. They were very great friends. And the Yankees would come in and, you know, pick the lass up off the stove and march her up to the bar. And of course, they were with us. They weren't going with the old boys, and you know. And it just light up. And anything used to set it off at the finish. Especially when Eisenhower made that remark.
What would the police and military police do?
Oh, they had a hard job if you got caught. But I think they were sympathetic to us. Anyhow, they came one day and started putting this fence up. And then one morning, the NCOs were sent for and told, in future, nobody left the camp. It mean nobody. There would be guards outside the camp. Anybody caught, it was a court-martial. If he got out, he'd be shot on sight. And...
So you were sealed in?
We were sealed in.
That would be the end of May then.
Mm-hmm. And the Yankee Marines were the boys on guard duty, which didn't go down very well. But nobody got out. And then we started the briefing. And I can only speak for myself here because, as I say, I missed 2 years of the fighting. It was the best briefing I have known in the forces. Because even the private soldier was at the briefing. And you did scale models, you did attacks on the model. Each section did an attack. There was a picture gallery of not where we were going, but what to expect, guns, minefields, and such as that. And then we were ready for embarkation and stood down. And then the next day we moved out. Went down to Southampton, and I also went on lighters out to these LCIs. And Churchill and King George were standing on the quayside. And Churchill got the biggest roast in his life. Off the troops. The biggest roasting in his life off the troops. He's standing there with his fingers up. He got more than his fingers up. And we
went... Was he not popular, or was it just...
No, he wasn't popular.
Why not?
I don't know why not. Because, you know, when you talk to, other individual, they all used to say the same thing. He was the only man that could have kept England going. It was like Monty. As I say, there's only 50% people like Monty. The other 50 didn't, although they accepted him as a leader. And Churchill, they accepted as a leader. But the boys, I think it was the wrong thing for Churchill to have done, or the King. Well, you're going on to an LCI, and you know the next day you're either finished or you're still alive. And I think it was the wrong time to go and cheer the lads on.
Was it his politics as well?
I don't think it was. In those days, you know, in the forces before the war, you weren't allowed to talk politics. And it wasn't till the latter part of the war that they started bringing politics into the ABC, what they used to call it, ABC. You used to go on lectures where they used to. So I wouldn't say it was politics. I think it was a lot of people that'd been ready for demarcation, then they'd been stood down, and then they were going again. And everybody's edgy. You know, am I going to get through, or is it going to be all over? And a man's in a funny state of mind at that particular time. And I honestly think, I don't know what other people might think, I honestly think it was the wrong time for Churchill and the King.
Was any of it directed at the King? Was he dead?
Not the. Well, I don't know whether they directed. But everybody was booing, you know, and jeering at Churchill standing like this, you know, and a big cigar in his mouth.
Did you actually see the King there?
Oh, yes. I mean, we passed within. Why, from here to that, them houses over there.
Just about 25 yards away.
Oh, you could see him standing there. And Churchill was standing about 5 yards away with his, you know, his big cigar. And, of course, he got jeered. And we went aboard, and then it was stood down again. And so we were brought ashore into the... what they call them now, these big bond houses or whatever they are. And we got a meal in there, and the next day we got on...
That was the third you'd gone on board, and you came back off again on the 4th of June.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And we just spent a day lounging about, and then we went back on board, and... the word came round, this is it, now or never. And of course we set sail. And the 8th Battalion was in reserve. 6th Battalion the 151 Brigade was in reserve, but the 6th and 9th were going in first. The 8th Battalion was going in second. And we were supposed to land somewhere around about D plus 8 hours, I think it was, or 6 hours. But we didn't land till... didn't go ashore till 11:30.
What do you remember of the crossing? Because the weather was quite rough, wasn't it?
It was rough. But... I could always sleep. And I always remember about 8 o'clock I got up, and my company's job was these folding bikes you were talking about. We had to carry them ashore with us as we went ashore, pile them up on the beach, and B Company had to grab these bikes and cycle, I think it was 3 mile, to a crossroad and capture this crossroad. And just before I went ashore, the American Navy issued us with waterproof trousers that you put your feet in as well. You know, and the trick is, when you put them in, to squeeze all the air out before you tie them. And the lads was going in the water, and our LCI, the water was up to here when you stepped off.
Chest.
Stepped off the end of the. That's as far as they could get in. We were up to here. And we all had this bike on our packs. And the lads were stepping off, and of course, the feet were shooting in the air because they hadn't squeezed the air out. And there was a lad in, the lad in front of me, he was a Cockney. And he was about 6 foot. And he stepped into the water and his feet shot up. And I dragged him up. And he'd lost the bike. So he was diving in for the bike. And I, get ashore, let the bloody bike back. And we got ashore anyhow.
What was the scene during that landing, while you were landing? What
well, next to, right next to us was one of these, I don't know whether they're LCIs or LCTs, with these rocket guns on. There must have been about 50 guns on. And it's shoo, shoo. That's all it was doing, is going back, backward like that. And on the other side, they were eyeing the wounded in off the beaches that I suppose they were the people that had done the actual invasion, looking for mines and these things to stop the tanks and that. And we run up the beach.
Were you under fire at all?
Very little, very little. Till we'd been on the beach for about 20 minutes. And there was two or three explosions, and our MO, that's where he was injured. And then we walked through this village, also remember, because there's two girls standing under the lamppost. Had we time? And we walked through and just walked up the road towards Bayer. And about 6 o'clock at night, we would be, what? I think 6 or 7 miles inland. And we were told to dig in for the night.
So there was no sign of fighting as far as you were concerned?
We met nobody. No, not a soul, once we got off the beach. I'm talking about my company. I'm not talking about anybody else. And about 6 o'clock at night, we were told to halt for the night and dig in. And we dug in, and there was a farmhouse about 100 yards to my front, and a road. And at the side of this farmhouse was like a cart track going up into a wood. And I could see at the back of this farmhouse a building, but I couldn't see what it was. And during stand two, I heard this half track start up. And it came from, it looked to me to come from the back of the farmhouse onto this cart track. And away light the clappers. And so we thought, well, okay, Jerry's pulled out. And it was all quiet all night. The next morning we formed up to move off, and we'd gone about 200 yards, and I spotted this building again. And what it was, I do not know, but there was three buildings. One must have been, could have been a convent or a school or something. And the CO asked me to go with three sections and search this place, because this is where this half track had come from. And so I took two sections into this big building, and I sent a section into the one that was standing on its own. And it had been a German headquarters. And when we went through the front door, we met an old Frenchman and an old French woman and a young French woman who were two maids, if you looked at them. And they told us there was no Bosch, the Bosch had gone. Anyhow, we locked them three in a room and searched the place. And there was officers' bedrooms, tailors' shops, cobblers' shops, everything.